The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. Just love yourself, God, and neighbor, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about what the Church's perspective is on what's going on in the world. And, you know, sometimes some of the topics we talk about may not seem kind of very churchy. And I guess one of the reasons for that is that our Christian faith is not merely heavenly. Our Christian faith is earthly because Jesus Christ, we believe, in his incarnation, in his birth, became truly human, and he walked our earthly land, quite not the land of the United States of America, obviously, but he worked the land of Palestine. He worked the area which we now know as Jerusalem, the area we now know as Nazareth, Galilee, Judea, and he walked that area. And so when we kind of think about what's going on in the world, we realize that that's the world that Jesus came to save, and that's the world that Jesus lived in, where he grew up, where he tragically died on the cross, but tragically yet salvifically, and where he was raised from the dead. And so therefore, quite frankly, as the Second Vatican Council would say, you know, there's really nothing that's outside of the joys and the sorrows, the tears, the hopes, the pains of humankind that is beyond the consideration of the people of God. Because if it's human, we need to think about it. Now, that's not saying that if it's human, it's good. It's saying that if it's human, it's kind of part of what we need to reflect upon, think about, develop a perspective on in order to figure out how we do that from our Christian and our Catholic perspective. So that's why we talk about a lot of different things in On Just Love, because we talk about so many things in the world, and then kind of we invite you, our listeners, to say, okay, so what's my faith tell me about that? What's the perspective that I should use to kind of think about those things? And that's why this week we are going to kind of focus on what was going on right near where we broadcast from in New York City at the United Nations, because last Friday, April 22nd, Earth Day, leaders of 175 nations gathered here to sign the Paris Agreement on climate change and to usher in what is being called a record-breaking effort to tackle global warming. And over the next few years, the countries around the world will be taking steps to reduce their nation's carbon emissions, and they need both a plan and they need the public support to do it. And so our first guest will be a leader at the UN Sustainable Development Solution Network, and he's working to ensure that every country has a climate action plan. And later on, we're going to speak with a professor of public policy on why, according to kind of his perspective and maybe some of the research he's done, the average citizen doesn't really take this as a major issue, and they kind of rank it towards the end of their priorities and what is important for them to consider. So thank you for tuning in and joining us on Just Love today. And why don't we go to our first guest? Our first guest is Guido Smith Traub. He is the executive director of the United Nations Sustainable Development Solutions Network. And we're delighted that he's taking the time to be with us. Guido, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
Great. So, you know, I'm delighted that we're seemingly, I would think, I'm going to say we're making some progress in this area of climate change and development. I know you worked on the Millennial Development Project. So you a little bit happy these days about the progress we're making on some of these global issues?
I'm very happy with the progress that was made by nations that came together last December in Paris in France to conclude what was really a historic agreement. They've resolved that they need to work together. All countries need to work together to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, so that the temperature of the world, the average temperature, is not increased by more than 2 degrees Celsius, which is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. That is a huge breakthrough, because every country, including China, including many of the countries which so far had not taken on commitments to do so, joined in making this a historic pledge. The challenge now is to move towards implementation.
Okay. So you've been around this for a while. You've worked on the Millennium Goals. And as you described, this is kind of a historical agreement. You know, as an insider, were you surprised that it happened? Or did you kind of say, hey, I really thought this was going to really happen?
I was surprised, very positively surprised, because when you get 194 countries together that have to agree on an agreement that everyone can sign up to, you often end up with a compromise solution that tends to be not as ambitious as needed. And here we really had a breakthrough agreement, and that was in large part thanks to the leadership of the French government, which hosted the COP. And many of the leaders, including President Obama, played a very, very important role through years of careful diplomacy with, in particular, the Chinese president. So there are many, many fathers to the success. But I think it was certainly unexpected for me, the clarity and the ambition of that agreement.
So, you know, some of our listeners, and you could educate me a little bit on this, tell us a little bit the highlights. What did the, you know, what the agreement agree to do?
So the agreement has several parts. I think the most important part is that all countries now agree that climate change is very dangerous. I know you're going to speak about what it means for the average American today, later in the show, and that we need to limit temperature increase to these famous 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And the second part is that every country is now agreed to reduce emissions, to make an effort. Because before, earlier agreements have said that there were industrialized countries, the rich countries, including the United States, Europe, and other parts of it. But of course, most of the emissions in the past, and therefore should really take the lead in reducing them. So we no longer have this division between different groups of countries. Third, the agreement includes a number of provisions that include that are specific mechanisms for how to go about reducing these emissions and how to go about this effort in a transparent way. So every country will now prepare a long-term strategy for reducing emissions. So what will the United States look like in 2050 if we are to reduce emissions as required? And I think that really is the right question that every country needs to ask, and that's what we're now working towards seeing happening in every country.
And is there a time frame by which they're supposed to develop their plan?
Yes, there is a time frame. So the agreement will enter into force in 2020. It takes a while for all these countries to pass the agreement in their parliament, which is called ratification. And these long-term strategies should be out by 2020. But we really don't want to wait that long. In 2018, countries are going to come together to review progress. It's an informal stock-taking. And that's a really great opportunity for the leading countries to put forward their strategies. And that's what we're hoping they will do, because they will set an example for others to follow. And then what's really important is once you have these long-term strategies out there, then business have a clear perspective. They can then work knowing in advance what kind of policy signals they will be getting to reduce emissions. It'll drive technological innovation. So it really, everything in a way depends on having a clear strategy.
We're speaking with Guido Schmidt-Traub, the Executive Director of the United Nations Sustainable Development Solution Network. And we're speaking to him about the historic agreement that was developed in Paris at the end of last year, 2015, in which almost 200 nations got together last week at the United Nations in New York on Earth Day to kind of sign to move forward on this. And we're talking about something that's, you know, pretty positive because it is an advance in which, you know, developing nations and developed nations all got together to do this. So, Guido, tell, you know, That, what period of time are we trying to not raise the temperature too much? Is that for a year, or is it a decade, or how long?
Well, it's really forever, ultimately. So what's happening right now is we're putting out out greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels is the most important one, and that leads to warming of the average temperature. This effect is now well understood, and there really isn't any doubts among the scientists as to it. And because these gases stay in the atmosphere for a long time, so any carbon dioxide you put out today will stay in the atmosphere for about 100 years. So we really need to think about how we can grow our economies without emitting greenhouse gases. So what this means is that instead of using petrol for the cars, we should be using electricity. And that electricity has to be produced from renewable energy sources and other energy sources that don't emit greenhouse gas emissions. So we're not talking about changing people's lives fundamentally. We're not talking about giving up cars or giving up spacious homes. We're just talking about designing them in a much, much smarter way, using modern technology so that we can enjoy the same standard of living without without emitting these greenhouse gas emissions. And basically, we need to... Sorry, yeah.
Go ahead. Finish your
thought. And basically, we need to complete this transition out of emitting greenhouse gases by the middle of the century, basically. So by sort of 2060-70, we really need to be getting close to zero.
Now, so the question which I've heard people ask, so let me ask you, since you know what you're talking about and I don't, is what I've heard people say is, well, you know, there's a cost to doing this, and there's a cost to kind of using this. And, hey, wait a minute. Okay, so the developed countries now are saying, okay, we got our share by kind of abusing system, but now we're imposing that additional cost on developing nations who don't have the resources to kind of do that. I mean, is there anything to that conversation?
Well, obviously, this is going to cost some money. Thankfully, it'll cost a lot less money now than it would have cost even 10 years ago because technologies are improving. Renewable energy is becoming competitive in many parts of the world, and so what needs to happen is that we shift towards these new technologies, and many American companies are leaders in this space, and they will develop new markets. We estimate that it will cost about 1% of gross domestic product, which is basically 1% of income, to do this transition, which is actually not that much money given the depth of the changes we're talking about. So for an average American family, estimates range to sort of to an increase in sort of power bills and the cost of fuels in the range of sort of $40 per year per person, which is significant, but it's not. I would argue it's not a barrier towards doing this. So affordability doesn't seem to be the major barrier. The major challenge now is to get organized, in particular to invest in developing these new technologies.
What do you think the factors were that, that caused this to happen, to maybe your surprise, a number of people surprised? I mean, we always heard it said that, you know, some places like China have not been cooperative in terms of these issues. What got China to sign on?
Well, I think there are several things. Several things come together. One is there's really a growing realization that climate change is real. I know there's still many people who doubt it, but the science really is very clear, and we're seeing very clear signs of it happening. We're seeing signs in the United States. The water of the sea, the level of the sea is rising. We're having more storms. The Hurricane Sandy in New York was a big wake-up call. The Chinese are experiencing major droughts right now. So they're really seeing the climate change. That was one big factor. It was among leaders. There's very little doubt that this is happening. Second is we actually now have better solutions. I've mentioned this briefly. So many of these technologies are now affordable. So people have a clearer sense how this could be done. And China is also seeing that some of its companies will actually benefit from this transition because they will be able to sell more solar panels, which they should. And just like American companies will benefit from this because they're going to be selling more products and services. And the third element I would mention is really is moral leadership from leaders around the world. The Pope has played an absolutely central role with his encyclical Laudato Si that came out last summer. It really was a clarion call to action. It resonated among Catholics, of course, but really beyond or across all major faiths. And many, many major religious leaders followed his examples and issued similarly poignant calls and clear calls. We have many business leaders now calling for this. And so there's really been a shift that people are realizing that this is just happening. It's going to happen. So we're no longer questioning this. And now we're getting organized to actually get this done. And so in that way, the Paris Agreement was really a culmination of what has been a very intense process of learning and of mobilization and of moral leadership. And again, really grateful to the leadership of the Catholic Church and the Pope in particular on this issue.
Well, you know, it's interesting in the history of Catholic social teaching. They always used to talk about six kind of principles of Catholic social teaching. And kind of the way that mm-hmm. these things develop is everybody finds something and then they kind of run with it. So I think there was a half of a sentence in one of the encyclicals by Pope John Paul II that mentioned something like we should kind of take care of the earth or we should do something. And all of a sudden, everybody kind of began to run with that, so much so that probably a decade or so later, they added care for the environment, stewardship of creation, as kind of one of those seventh major theme of Catholic social teaching, which, you know, from my point of view, it certainly was there, but it wasn't quite as major until, as you mentioned, Pope Francis wrote his recent encyclical on the Earth, Our Mother, and then it kind of really kind of blossomed as a real full blown part of our perspective on the world.
Yeah, that's been really important. And we also, I should also mention, we're seeing this thing really happening even in the United States. So if you look at what's happening in California, you know, California is in the full swing of this transition. The state has already adopted many years ago the goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80%. And it's happening. And California's economy is doing well. It's creating more jobs. And it's positioning itself as a leader in clean energy. I think that was also a really important factor that particularly resonated in Washington, to see that a major state in the United States was already leading on this.
And particularly a state that is so kind of wedded to automobile transportation because of the distances and not a highly developed kind of mass transit system out there. If California can kind of deal with this, that is a little bit of hope that the rest of the country can deal with it.
Absolutely. And that's why Tesla Motors is there.
Well, the other thing, which, again, I think realistically, one of the things we got to recognize is, unfortunately, and I don't quite get it, but I guess I get it, is that, you know, unfortunately, in some of the political debates, and I would say in the United States, it's just purely ideological and it's not based on anything other than, I think, somebody's got to take an opposite point of view in order to differentiate themselves from somebody else, whether or not there's much basis to do it. So kind of we get into those, at least in this country, those political debates, not based on either the science or the reality, but just the need to kind of create an issue, I think. And that makes it a little bit hard to sometimes deal with it in some places.
I think that's right, and I think, I mean, every country's got its own way of dealing with these issues. In Europe, which is where I'm based, it doesn't matter whether you're left or right or the center. If you're the equivalent of a Republican or Democrat, climate science is just something that's accepted by everyone. But I do also see that this is a complex issue, and scientists need to do a better job at explaining this. I think they are getting better. I also see the discussion advance in the United States. I mean, there's a lot of business leaders from the states we work with who are absolutely clear about this. So I think this is happening. And as you say, I hope that that everyone can look beyond sort of the short term issues of elections and so, and look at the well-being of the planet as a human and not just colored through the eyes of a particular political party.
You know, I do think what you said is one of those issues that scientists have to come up with a better way to explain it. And I guess
right.
One of the things that I don't particularly like the word global warming, only because, I mean, this is just one person. I don't feel it's much warmer now than it was 10 years ago. I feel there's greater volatility. And when you talked mm-hmm. about Superstorm Sandy, I don't associate that with global warming. I do associate it with changes in volatility, which I think we've experienced. So like last winter here in New York, for example, it was a relatively mild winter, except we got dumped with 26 inches of snow in one day. And so, which is weird. And now the winter before that, it was freezing cold and we got a lot of stuff. So, you know, it's cold, it's warm. A lot of volatility, I think, is out there. And I don't know. That's my little kind of take on that might be a better way to get people's attention than merely talking about the temperature. But anyway, that's my take on it.
I think it's a very good point. And you know, my kids ask me that question too, Dad. What is this global warming? It feels really cold outside.
Right.
which is a very reasonable and very fair reaction. But at the same time, also we do have, and these are the climate is a complex thing. We have really good measurement. I mean, NASA has done an outstanding job at just tracking temperatures, and the data that's coming in is crystal clear. Last year in 2015 was by far and away the warmest year ever on record, and 2016 this looks set to beat every record. So there may be spells of cold in various places, but overall it's the change is really quite dramatic. And we're also seeing sea level rise. This is no longer just an abstraction. You're seeing it in Miami. There are more floods in Miami, and if we don't change it, many people believe that that the Keys in Florida will have to be abandoned sometime this century. So we're no longer talking about sort of a distant future. All of this is going to be happening in our lifetime. And I know one also has to be able to talk about these things without sounding alarmist, but it is true that the changes that we're seeing everywhere are profound.
Guido Smith-Traub, the Executive Director of the United Nations Sustainable Development Solutions Network. Hey, thanks so much for at least making me smarter, and I'm sure you've made our listeners smarter. And thanks so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love and for giving us a lot of hope that the nations of the world did come together to make a major advance. So, hey, thanks so much for sharing your insights, your time with us on Just Love. Thank you.
Thank you for the great chat.
Great. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. We're going to take a little break now, and join us when we come back on Just Love on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. And the world we're talking about today is our big world. And we're talking about issues of global warming, which I like to call climate volatility. I know why everybody uses global warming. It's a better phrase than climate volatility. But then when I get very cold in the winter, I say, oh, the climate's volatile. So that's why I want to use that. And when we have these big storms, it's not so much about warming, but there's a lot of extremes going on in the world, which I guess are the result of it being warming and growing in being warm. So a little bit later in our show, we're going to speak with a professor from New York University who we're going to talk a little bit about why, even though the science is pretty clear on this, according to the consensus among scientists, among the public, not a real high priority. So a little bit later on, we'll speak with Patrick Egan, who's a professor of politics and public policy at New York University here in New York. Our last guest, we're speaking to him from Europe, who is working on the UN there. So anyway, but while we do that, let's go to a little. Oh, Tom, I got to tell you, I'm not going to mention who this is, but but Tom and I find it a little strange that this is serious radio, and we got a lot of studios here, and there's radio shows, and there's one particular show that every time we come here, one of the hosts of that show is always getting a haircut.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, you know, for a radio show, you got to get a haircut. But Tom, I want to show you, he's getting a haircut.
Oh, very good. Okay.
So I just want to make
thank
sure.
Thank you, Monsignor. That was good.
Yeah, that was good. That was good. So you got any news for us, Tom?
We sure do. You know, we are mentioning the United Nations this week, Monsignor, and obviously that historic signing of the Paris Climate Accord. But that wasn't the only thing that went on in the United Nations this past week. On Thursday, the 21st, the United Nations General Assembly, and this is at the request of the nations of Mexico, Guatemala, and Colombia, held a special session on the world drug problem at its headquarters in New York. And on the agenda was the way the international community could cooperate better to fight the international drug trade.
So here's an issue, Tom. Mm-hmm. Colombia was there, right?
Colombia was there.
Okay. Do you know that there are 5.7 million displaced people in Colombia,
wow,
primarily based upon the drug wars, the drug trafficking that's been going on there for decades?
I didn't know.
5.7 million wow, people are displaced.
It's an incredible yeah, number when you wind up thinking about it. And that's probably one of the reasons Colombia asked for it, Monsignor, because, you know, they basically have said that, you know, sort of those three countries, Mexico, Colombia, and Guatemala, have really been the ground place, the ground war in the drug war. And they were really saying that they really want kind of the international community to look at this in a different way. So at the conclusion of the meeting, there was a general consensus among the delegates that there's a couple of things we can do besides just concentrating on prohibition and criminalization. They want to invest in more healthcare. They want to invest in more addiction treatment. And they want to invest in alternatives to incarceration to be able to wind up fighting this problem. I think beforehand, as you said, they concentrated primarily on prohibition, and that's probably what's causing this refugee problem, is one of the other problems that you wind up mentioning.
Yeah, probably that's the case. And the other issue is, in the United States, we have an increasing and growing problem of heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
And interestingly, economically, I'm told that one of the reasons for that is because heroin is pretty cheap to get.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's even cheaper than prescription painkillers, and therefore people kind of substitute that. So that's an issue which is very important to kind of consider and to deal with also.
It is. And, you know, actually, it's very interesting, but the bishops of Bolivia, Monsignor, last week issued actually a pastoral letter called I Place Before You Life and Death, that was a kind of a critique of the corrosive effect on public life that drug trafficking takes and drug addiction. It provoked actually an angry response from Bolivian President Evo Morales. What the bishop said in the pastoral was that narco trafficking threatens peaceful and democratic coexistence of the country. It brings violence, corruption, deceit, injustice, and death. And in response, President Morales said the bishops were demonstrating a colonial mentality and believed that we were still living in an ancient age when they think they have the last word. Now, once again, the thing that's interesting is Morales, in addition to being president of Bolivia, which I did not know, is also the head of a union of coca leaf growers, whose base is in the east of the country, which is the heartland of the drug trafficking mafias. And last week, you may remember we talked about on the news, Morales was one of the participants in the Vatican conference on the 25th anniversary of the papal encyclical Santissimus Annus. And Morales presented Pope Francis at that time with three books in Spanish that described the benefits of coca leaves, as well as a letter signed by the heads of two trade unions that complained about the Bolivian bishop's denunciation of coca cultivation.
Well, if that isn't a conflict of interest, I don't know what is.
That's a
really intriguing thing. So, anyway, so any other news?
Sure, Monsieur. You know, but just briefly, I think it should be mentioned. Obviously, in this past week, the music industry lost, I think, a tremendous talent. You may remember that the singer called Prince, whose given name was Prince Rogers Nelson, passed away at age 57 in his Minnesota home. And actually, the Vatican newspaper, La Osservatorio Romano, quoted him as a rare gift to the world of pop music in what they said is a gray world dominated by labels. And although his performance was sometimes a little off color, Prince often lifted up Christian overtones in his music. Prince was a winner of 7 Grammy Awards. He was raised Seventh-day Adventist, but he became a Jehovah's Witness later in life. And was known to go around his neighborhood passing out the Watchtower publication of the Jehovah's Witness.
You know, Tom, we're going to have to do a show, I think, sometime on how you deal with artists and how you deal with artists who have certain themes that are running through their things. I do think there's a lot to looking at contemporary music and looking at some of the themes that are there and to see how they tie in with some of our Christian themes. Now, I think the comment that was made there, obviously, there's some parts of Prince's thing. There's some raunchiness in Prince. Let's not make any mistake about it. At the same time, there's a lot of stuff that really has some deep values that are part of that. And the other part, which again is he was a firm believer at you know, at least for a good part of his life, in Jesus Christ.
I mean, once
I heard the story told that he wanted to do a documentary or film in which he put up before the audience Jesus Christ as Savior of the world and said, you know, let him deal with it. Let him deal with it. So I think that it's interesting that we do that. Now, again, a little bit of our own world. I mean, I do wind up listening to a fair amount of music, rock, pop music, because when I go to the gym, I just turn it on or I listen to what's there just to expose me to stuff that I probably wouldn't pick myself. Or when I'm in the car, I'll switch channels. But Prince was not somebody who I knew a whole lot about. I mean, I knew who he was, but since he passed away, since he died, I did do a fair amount of kind of listening to his stuff. You couldn't help it. And it's a very interesting perspective. So I think sometime we'll figure out how we kind of do a show with regard to that.
Great, Monsieur.
So why don't we take a break? And, you know, when we come back, we'll go to our second guest. This is Just Love. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. See you. Come back in 2 minutes on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Thank you. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, last Friday, leaders of 175 nations gathered here in New York to sign the Paris Agreement on climate change, which was negotiated in Paris last December. And over the course of the next few years, countries around the world have made a commitment that they're going to be taking steps to reduce their nation's carbon emissions, but they'll need both a plan and the public support to do it. And so our first guest talked about it from the point of view of the United Nations, and we're going to be speaking now with Patrick Egan, who is a professor of public policy. We're going to talk a little bit more about the average citizen and how the average citizen kind of views global warming. So let's go to our guest, Patrick Egan. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here, Monsignor. Thanks for having me.
Great. I am delighted that you are with us. So you're teaching at NYU?
That's right. That's right.
And what are you teaching this semester?
This semester, I'm teaching an advanced seminar on, this is actually quite relevant to the discussion, the relationship between public opinion and public policy in the United States. So do our elected leaders listen to the people when they're making decisions about policy?
In my kind of cynical point of view, I'd say certainly if they're big donors.
Well, there is some evidence for that. Actually, kind of more to the point, just that the well-off in the United States tend to have more influence on public policy than those that are not as well-off. There's a lot of kind of mounting evidence for that in political science. The donors, we think, probably have an additional edge, particularly on policies that are kind of hidden and not really seen by the public. So, yes, your instinct is probably correct.
But in any sense, that's interesting. I want to stick with that for a second. Why do those who are well off seemingly have more influence? Have you kind of gotten to the why question yet?
So the research that's been done in political science on this has been investigating that quite thoroughly. And there's a number of different hypotheses about why that's true. I think we still haven't quite settled on exactly what the mechanism is. I think the first thing is that well-off people actually tend to be a little bit more engaged politically. They're better educated. They've got more access to news and information. And they might even follow politics more closely than others. And so that kind of engagement and knowledge, of course, augments their influence on policy to start with. And then the other thing is that, generally, particularly when we move away from presidential elections to congressional and state-level elections, well-off people are much more likely to vote than the middle class and poor. And so that also is another reason why they might be expected to have more influence than other people, because they're actually showing up at the poll.
You know, Patrick, I think what you've said is something that I have kind of come to feel in a very unnuanced way. But that if we look at kind of poor people, rich people, those who have fewer economic resources, those who have greater economic resources, you tell me what the topic is. And I'm going to tell you that rich people are better off than poor people.
That's certainly the truth. And, you know, that's even true on issues that we don't necessarily associate so closely with the rich-poor divide, including climate change. You know, there's lots of evidence indicating that already and certainly in the decades to come, the less well-off in the United States and especially around the world are much more likely to suffer from the adverse effects of climate change than those who are better off.
Okay, so let me give you one anecdotal story about that kind of backs that up. Somebody who I've dealt with in my work at Catholic Charities is somebody who is, you know, on the higher end of the economic spectrum. Not a billionaire, but. You know, very comfortable enough that he could build a house kind of near the beach. And he kind of doubled or tripled, I don't know the exact number, the cost of that house because he made it, you know, so secure, raised it up enough that probably it would take the flood of Noah in order to get rid of that house.
Yeah, sure.
But
sure.
So there's going to be a storm someday, and probably a number of people's houses are going to get damaged. Maybe some of them will get washed away, but not his, because he was able to kind of reinforce it and do the things that do it. And the only reason he could do that is because, you know, he had the means in order to do it. Now, is that a bad thing to do? No, it's probably a safe thing to do. It's just that most people don't have the resources to be able to take that level of caution.
That's absolutely right. I think the story also illustrates another aspect of what makes climate change such a tough problem to handle, which is that it's sort of creeping up on us slowly. You know, you've got these big storms with storm surges, et cetera. And, you know, bit by bit, those who can are adapting, whether it's their homes or their towns or their seawalls or what have you. But what that means is that over time, inequalities get exaggerated by this problem, because those who can adapt, and those who can't are going to suffer as a result of these deleterious effects of climate change.
So let's go into that topic. I mean, I think one of the things you've discovered is that kind of you ask people, you know, what's really important in terms of kind of public policy issues? What do we need to focus on, or what are you focused on? It seems that kind of climate change gets real down there at the bottom of the list in terms of their priorities. Now, you just said a little bit about that. Say a little bit more about what you've discovered with regard to that.
Absolutely. And some of this is, you know, our own original research, and others is what research that's been done by other political scientists.
Now, I'm not a professor like you. So you know how I do my research? Here's how I do my research. When I go to Thanksgiving with my family, yeah, I ask kind of the older generation person a question, and then I'll go in the other room and I'll ask one of the college kids, and then I'll ask, you know, one of the men and one of the women. And then I that's kind of my little sample of what they all say.
Your informal public opinion.
Right.
That. That's good. I would say that in public opinion in the United States on climate change, there's sort of three different things that we've been thinking about. First is, do you believe that it's happening? And of course, there's a fair amount of division about that within the population, about whether it's happening, and then even if it's happening, to what extent is it blamed on human activity, or others believe that this is just part of some natural variation in the climate. Now, of course, that's at odds with the overwhelming scientific consensus that this is happening, and that it has been caused by human activity, and that the only way to mitigate it is going to be to change the carbon emissions and other emissions that we put out into the atmosphere.
Patrick, let me interrupt.
Yeah,
Patrick Egan is the professor of politics and public policy at NYU, and we're speaking about climate change, public opinion on that. You know, Patrick, what I wanted to interrupt you, our previous guest, who really has a European perspective, he was kind of talking as if, you know, everybody agrees on this. There's no dispute about this. And I'm listening to the political debate in this country, and every politician will kind of trot out at least somebody who's got a PhD, a scientist, who kind of will give a contrary opinion. But he was putting it forth like there's such, you know, everybody agrees this. Do you think there's a little difference in public opinion on, as we would say, this side of the pond and the other side of the pond?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think that's a good instinct. There's a lot more consensus among European publics that global climate change is happening and that we need to do something about it. Whereas in the United States, the public is more divided on whether human-caused climate change is taking place. And unfortunately, this is the other aspect of public opinion that's worth talking about, is that we just place a very, very low priority on doing anything about it. So, for example, the Pew Research Center every year gives Americans a list of different policy challenges about which we, you know, might take action, and asks essentially Americans to rank those issues. And maybe there are 20 each year. Climate change ends up near or at the bottom every single year, well below things like, I don't know, the budget deficit or tax reform or kind of other, you know, pretty obscure issues. But it just goes to show you how little Americans are worried about climate change. And I would include even those on the Democratic side of the spectrum, where more of the support comes from. It still doesn't rank super high on the list of voters' concerns.
You know, let me ask you this question. I mean, if you do a forced ranking, something's got to be last. Even if it's important, it's got to be last.
Right.
If you used, pardon me, if you used a Likert scale, in other words, if you did a 1 to 5,
sure. Yeah.
If you did a 1 to 5, 1 to 10, you get any different answers?
You know, unfortunately, you don't. You still see Americans giving climate change pretty low scores on those scales.
Okay.
And compared to other problems that are, you know, and let's be clear, the problems that Americans rank high, whether they're liberal or conservative, are problems that they perceive to be immediate and threatening. And
right.
At this point, Americans don't see climate change as either of those things. They can see it as a problem that's going to be happening in the future. And they're still trying to understand exactly how it threatens their day-to-day existence. I think that's still a story that has not been made clear to the average American. And so compared to something like crime or, what to do about immigration or what to do about the economy, something like global climate change is just a much more abstract and far away issue that leads people to rank it quite low on their list of priorities.
Hey, let me give you another anecdote. So last year when the encyclical of Pope Francis came out on the Earth, Our Mother, Laudato Si.
Yeah, sure.
And when that came out, I had on a guest on my show who's really big into it. And it was one of those really, really hot days. And her response to me is, "He wants me to turn down the air conditioning when it's so hot." I mean, in the midst of this like 200-page document, what caught her attention, who was a pretty sophisticated person, was turn down the air conditioning.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, some other research that we've done shows that Americans, one way that Americans think about climate change is exactly that, which is they respond to particularly hot or particularly cold days by adjusting the extent to which they believe climate change is happening. On an unusually hot day, they're more likely to say, "Oh, yeah, climate change is real." And an unusually cold day, they're actually less likely to think it's real or a problem. So, yeah, it just goes to show you that even quite sophisticated people who are engaged with this issue are affected by these, much more heuristic sort of ways of thinking about the problem.
But, you know, Patrick, I know this is not your job nor probably your area of expertise, but I think what you said is right, that somehow this hasn't captured the imagination of the majority of, let's just say, the American public. You got any ideas about how we might raise this up in the awareness of people?
Yeah, you know, so there's one idea that actually hasn't really been talked about very much, and it's actually so straightforward that it's sort of surprising that it hasn't been. And that is that many of the emissions, you know, that are contributing to global climate change are air pollutants. That is, they're the very same things that cause asthma and other sorts of problems and diseases that we associate with dirty air, you know, air pollution.
Right.
And that problem is one that I think the typical person, whether a Republican or Democrat, can understand and also understand why we would want to take immediate action on. You know, if we can reduce asthma rates among our kids, reduce rates of cancers that are caused by airborne carcinogens, et cetera, that's a really obvious and immediate goal. And if we were to actually do that, we would also be fighting climate change at the same time. So one of the kind of upshots of all of this is that it may be that talking about climate change as a sort of global abstract issue is not necessarily the most effective communication tool. And instead, we need to think about immediate, tangible things that we can do that have immediate positive effects on our well-being. And there's a lot of them, as it turns out.
Well, you know, I've thought when I've read these documents and I've read this thing, one of the ways I would do it is not to talk about climate change, but I talk about pollution.
Exactly.
You know, because, like, who can be in favor of polluting?
Right.
Nope, nobody.
Right.
And we should be against polluting, and everybody is. Now, I mean, but if we agree that we shouldn't pollute and less pollution is better than more pollution, all of those things, at least you get a common basis. I mean, then you get into the issue of, well, should you mandate it and should there be taxes if you overpollute? I mean, that's another, you know, another. But I think that's a word that people want. And again, I find that to be very nonpartisan, because if you see, you know, a stream or something that's smelly or it's dirty or it's got oil in it, you know, almost everybody says, that's not a good thing to do.
Yeah, that's right. And I also think that, you know, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, if you're living near a source of air pollution, your kids are affected, you know, and we can all think about the rising rates of asthma among our kids. And that's true among upper class, middle class, and working class kids, right? So there are, I think, again, very tangible effects that are tied to, as you say, pollution.
Okay.
That might make the climate change problem.
So one of the things we do, Patrick, with our guests is we make them the czar of this issue. So you're in charge of.
Oh boy. Okay.
So you get 2 minutes to tell us what you as the czar are going to do. What two or three things are you going to do to save the world from pollution and they? Okay.
All right. That's
2 minutes.
That's
to
a
do
tall
it.
Order. Okay. Right. Well, you know, again, I think first, there are lots of things here in the United States that we can do to clean up air polluting sources that, again, would have this good downstream effect on climate change as well. So as we were just talking, that would definitely be a top priority for me. You know, a second issue would be some kind of global agreement where countries agree to.
Hey, we just got one. You want another one?
We'll see if that actually ends up, you know, being enforced. I think that's the question, right? Which is, we've got this agreement. It's not going to be ratified by a Republican Senate in the United States. And so the question will be to what extent those goals are followed, because, of course, we've had other global agreements in the past. To varying degrees of success and lack thereof. So it's sort of, you know, if I were a czar, what I'd do is somehow make sure that those agreements were enforced and followed by all of the countries in the world. And again, the United States is not only the only culprit here. There's, you know, lots of countries that are failing to meet these goals.
I got to tell you, I was happy that China signed on.
Well, it's absolutely necessary that China signs up because, as your listeners know, that's a growing economic power that not on a per capita basis, but certainly on a total basis, is going to be a bigger emitter of carbon pollution than the U.S. quite soon.
Okay, and you get one more. You get a third thing you can do.
I get a third thing. I think it would be really paying attention to how this problem is affecting inequality. And so taking extra care of the world's most vulnerable people, that's both here in the United States and around the world. And, you know, even if we were to start a solution, a great solution now, it would take several decades for all of these trends to be reversed in the global climate. And so until then, we've got to do the kinds of adaptations necessary, particularly for the world's most vulnerable populations, to make sure that they suffer less than they will if we do nothing.
Hey, Patrick Egan, professor of public policy at NYU, thank you so much for sharing your insights and taking the time to be with us on Just Love. I really appreciate it. And
no,
best of work in all your
Thanks
work.
Thanks for having me.
Great. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. And we've talked about our world this this week. And we talked about how we got to take care of it. It is our mother, Mother Earth. And the Pope has told us it's important that we do so. And the scientists tell us, and let's not pollute anymore. Let's try to reduce our emissions and be a little bit more caring of our Earth. Thanks for being with us. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.